The words we live by.
The National Broadcasting Company and its affiliated independent stations present The Words We Live By, the summer series of the Eternal Light program, which comes to you under the auspices of the Jewish Theological Seminary of America. Today we present Wisdom Books of the Bible, the fifth in this series of 15 outstanding literary dialogues of past years, featuring Mark Van Doren and Maurice Samuel, two of America's foremost men of letters. Mr. Samuel.
Mark, here we've arrived, I think, at the book Ecclesiastes, I don't know how much time we can give to it in our review of the wisdom books. And the very first thing I want to ask you is, do you agree with the title which has been given popularly to this book, Ecclesiastes, or Kohelet, to give him his Hebrew name, has been typed as the gentle cynic? Do you think that's a fitting title for him? Is that all he is?
No, I think that's a minor title. That's a sentimental title. I think he is neither cynical nor gentle. He has come upon in his age, in his old age, because he does write like a very old man. He has come upon a view of the world which is difficult for him to assimilate to himself, but I do not believe that it's an agreeable view, even to him. He is troubled by the fact that he can no longer see the glory of, in the world that once was there. He is frank in the statement of his predicament. The world has become bare and to some extent meaningless for him. But I do not believe he is a gently smiling cynic. I think he is troubled in spirit, and that's why, incidentally, I take very little stock in the so-called higher criticism of this book. Do you, incidentally?
No, I'm anxious to hear what you have to say about it. There are so many apparent contradictions in the points of view that it's very easy indeed to talk about different sources. I don't agree with it, and I'd like to know what you think about it.
Well, I think I've suggested my view already when I said that I take the author of this book as being truly troubled in spirit. He is an absolutely honest man. And he's begun to find it a little more difficult than he used to find it to understand what is meant by wisdom. The wisdom literature before him, of course, was ancient. There had been wise men since the beginning of time. And they had tended to say the same things over and over again, such as that the good are rewarded and the evil are punished, and that life is quite a simple thing. If one puts his mind to it. Life has become complicated for him, and there are certain defeating things in it which trouble him. And he says what those are, very frankly and incidentally, very beautifully, so that this is one of the classics of all the literature of the world. But I believe he's troubled, and from time to time, he, as it were, Maurice, corrects himself, checks himself, and says, yes, but. Now, that is why I have no patience with those scholars, like Maurice Gestreau, for instance, who a generation or so ago were for throwing away about a third of this book as not part of the original document. All of those parts in it which check and in some sense remind the author of what he once believed and what he still can believe if he tries hard enough, all of those are supposed to go out as nonsensical pieties interpolated by later second-rate authors.
Yes, I not only agree with you, Mark, I would add something to it. Even if it were true, and it may be true that there have been additions, what we have here is something which is organic in itself, whether there have or have not been additions. If you take a folk song, which is perfect, and you consider what its origins are, it may have had two or three authors, but it has become, in the mind of the people to which it belongs, in the mind of the nation to which, to the treasury of which it belongs, it is something organic and whole. And it's part of what one might call the genetic fallacy, to try and look back upon its origins as an explanation of its content instead of reconciling what apparent contradictions there are in order to see the unity behind them. Here, for instance, something that causes me to pause and ponder almost at the beginning, after he has unburdened himself a little of his distress and of his confusion, he starts off very grandly like this. I, Koheleth, have been king over Israel in Jerusalem. And I applied my heart to seek and to search out by wisdom concerning all things that are done under heaven. It is a sore task that God hath given to the sons of men to be exercised therewith. I have seen all the works that are done under the sun, and behold, all is vanity and a striving after wind. The first thing that I would like to ask, taking this as a unity, did he as a young man set out to search wisdom, or did he set out as a young man to have a good time, and now in retrospect he says, well, I was experimenting in order to find out the meaning of life? What do you think?
Well, I should think that he had started out seriously enough, but seriousness in a young man can mean no more than taking on faith from older men certain propositions about the world. As the young man grows older, he discovers that sometimes it's difficult to reconcile these propositions with what seems to happen. Things are not so clear as they once were, not so easy. Everything happens over and over again. Life repeats itself. Life is dull, for one thing, but particularly life repeats itself. And those simple rewards and punishments that the wise men said always came do not seem to come with that certainty that once was promised. Also, there is that oblivion in which all things seem to fall. The human race seems at times to have a very short memory. It does not remember its best people.
Look, you said, you spoke last week, you raised this question of the pursuit of wisdom and the limitations of it. Here again, as in all parts of the wisdom literature, that note is sounded. He says, I applied my heart to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. I perceived that this also was a striving after wind. Then, he says, for in much wisdom is much vexation, and he that increaseth knowledge increaseth sorrow. Now, there is a curious note, the contradiction. After we are exhorted over and over again to seek wisdom, we are told, you seek it to your own undoing.
Well, it is a curious paradox of human life, that our knowledge is supposed to make us happy, and doubtless, I suppose, ultimately should, and yet sometimes seems merely to have introduced us to experiences and to conceptions that we almost wish we hadn't had. Maybe our knowledge merely introduces us to the to complexities of the world that are not to be understood. And from time to time, I think anyone understands that. You know, the student must every now and then stop studying. He must relax. The boy who is too intent upon being this or being that must sometime forget his ambition. We all know that. All work and no play makes Jack a dull boy. A.E. Housman, in our time, that is to say, roughly speaking, our time, has written a very charming poem about this called Think No More. Think no more, lad. Laugh. Be jolly. Why should men make haste to die? Empty heads and tongues are talking. Make the rough road easy walking, and the feather pate of folly bears the falling sky. Oh, 'tis jesting, dancing, drinking spins the heavy world around. If young hearts were not so clever, oh, they would be young forever. Think no more, 'tis only thinking lays lads underground.
It's very beautiful, but rather self-defeating.
Oh, of course
I mean, he speaks in very melancholy tones about the happiness of gaiety, but he does it in a way which is extremely depressing.
Well, so for that matter is the author of our book here, who when he says eat, drink, and be merry,
takes your appetite away.
It does not sound like a very happy man.
No,
it's a counsel of despair.
He insists over and over again that he's tried everything. I said in my heart, come now, I will try thee with mirth and enjoy pleasure. And behold, this also was vanity. I said of laughter, it is mad. And of mirth, what doth it accomplish? Well, what did he expect it to accomplish? And then he goes on, I searched in my heart out to pamper my flesh. And I'll just quote little parts of it. I made me great works. I builded me houses. I made me gardens. I planted trees. I made me pools. So on and so on and so on. And I was great and increased more than any that were before me in Jerusalem. Then I looked on all the works that my hands had wrought, and on the labor that I had labored to do, and behold, all was vanity and a striving after wind, and there was no profit under the sun. And then he goes on, almost immediately, and says, then I saw that wisdom exceedeth folly as far as light excelleth darkness. The wise man, his eyes are in his head, but the fool walketh in darkness. Apparently, he can't come to a conclusion. He's tormented all the time. He can't let go of wisdom, and he can't find happiness in it.
Yes, but you know, that is just the point where the higher critic would come in and say, this must be an interpolation by some later, second-rate, pious person.
Yes.
No,
those are two other fellows.
Yes. Of course, these commentators, these higher critics, never seem to understand that they might be second-rate themselves.
Isn't it true, by the way, that this, Mark, that this tendency to reintegrate the old works is now appearing in other fields, too?
Yes, it has. Of course, in, as far back as the 18th century, it appeared in studies of Homer and Shakespeare. You see, every great book or every great set of books has come in for this treatment. I've been very much amused to see in my own lifetime a very great change with respect to Homer. I think many scholars now say not merely that the Iliad and the Odyssey, that each one of them is an integral work, the work of one hand, but that both are by the same hand. There was a time when they were throwing Shakespeare's plays out, many of them.
Yes.
They were either not by him or they were collaborators. Now, nobody pays attention to that anymore.
I wonder whether there is in that a touch of envy, a touch of incredulity about something very great that no one man could have done that. You remember the story of the old lady who went to hear Hamlet for the first time and said she didn't enjoy it because there were so many quotations in it?
Yes. It's incredible that one man could have written that play.
That perhaps may be the reason for the uncertainty.
Well, I'm sorry to say that I attribute this to a misunderstanding of democracy. Democracy, I think, ideally means that every man may be very great. I'm afraid it has come to mean that no man can be very great. We tend to envy, as I say, such towering geniuses as Homer and Shakespeare. We tend to think that no one man could have done that, and so it must have been a collection of men. It must have been the human race. However, our...
Very rare, by the way, is collaboration among men brings forth the greatest work. The only instance I can actually think of where an imperishable piece of work was done by a committee was the King James translation of the Bible.
Well, or
I can't think of any other that produced something really immortal.
Most of the translations of the Bible that I know have been done by committees, too, but that one is particularly famous.
Although for that matter they relied enormously, you remember, on the work of their predecessor, Tyndale, so that it was one man who dominated. In any case, I think there's a good deal in what you say, the fear of some, we might almost say a godlike figure appearing among men tends to make the average man whittle him down to the ordinary size in order that he shouldn't feel himself excluded from the pantheon.
As a matter of fact, Maurice, the maddest thing that higher criticism could do, it hasn't even thought of doing this, I'm sure, the maddest thing would be to throw Ecclesiastes as a whole out of the Bible, because of his very searching investigation of these disturbing things. The most disturbing thing of all being that as one grows old, one does find it hard to see the world as one wanted to see it as a youth, and perhaps as one did. This author has come upon some very hard truths, such as the heart of the sons of men is full of evil, and madness is in their heart while they live, and after that they go to the dead.
But by the way, when you read that passage, it evokes this thought to me. Wasn't it extraordinary that the makers of the Hebrew canon did include the book in the Bible?
I think it's simply wonderful that they did. That's true of many things in the Bible, as a matter of fact. A more timid people would have cast them out, but they left them in, I think, to the eternal glory of the makers of that book, because everything, finally, is in this book. And if this had not been here, if Ecclesiastes had not been here, I think a terribly important dimension of the mind would have been smothered. Here, for instance, is his perception that perhaps too great an assiduity in well-doing can be a kind of a misdeed, too. There is a righteous man that perisheth in his righteousness, as there is a wicked man that prolongeth his life in his evil doing. Be not righteous overmuch, neither make thyself overwise. Why shouldst thou destroy thyself? He also says, of course, be not overmuch wicked, neither be thou foolish. Why shouldst thou die before thy time?
Isn't that an extraordinary thing?
Amazing.
He said, no, the most extraordinary is, be not overmuch wicked. Yeah. I mean, there is a certain amount of license, as if to say, well, you know, I suppose you have to sin a little bit, but don't overdo it. It reminds me, there's a saying of Machiavelli's. He said, people with a weak stomach should not try to be wicked because they'll break down in the middle. You've got to have a character for being wicked just as you have to have a character for being good.
Well, you know, this man is, I think, a very wise man, as men call pessimists often are. My own experience of pessimists, I suppose I'm not one myself, is that they have an excellent time in the world. Because they don't expect anything. So when anything good comes, it's all gravy. And,
yes.
And wonderful. Vexation is better than laughter, for by the sadness of the countenance, the heart may be gladdened.
But you're perfectly right. A real pessimist wouldn't have written anything. And to the extent that Diogenes bothered to make a wisecrack at Alexander and said to him, just get out of the sun, he wasn't a pessimist. He was showing off. He was having a good time.
That's right.
He was making a bid for immortality, that he was able to say to the conqueror of the world, all I want from you is to get out of the sunlight.
Maurice,
the true pessimist really keeps quiet.
Of course he does. Maurice, I'd like to ask you about the very famous list of things in the third chapter of Ecclesiastes, of things for which there is a time. To everything there is a season, and a time to every purpose under the heaven. In my reading about the book, I've discovered that scholars vary in their interpretation of the word time and season, or the phrase there is a time for. Does it mean, in your opinion, well, just wait long enough and the time will come around again for this and around again for that?
It can mean that, and I have always taken it as something else. I've taken it to mean that when things happen, it is because the circumstances have ripened for it. And don't try to anticipate a situation. Don't try to rush the development of things.
Which
agrees to some extent with the interpretation that you give, but introduces into it more the element of resignation and propriety. There's a time for this thing. Don't force a thing unseasonably. There's a time to be born, that is to say, don't regret that you weren't born before,
yeah,
or that you weren't born in a later age. This was the time when you were to be born. And when the time comes for you to die, well, that's been arranged. And so with the rest of them, a time to plant and a time to pluck up that which is planted. A time to kill and a time to heal. There is a season for all of these things. There is a constellation of circumstances which makes that the proper thing. That's how I interpret it.
A time to weep and a time to laugh. A time to mourn and a time to dance. A time to cast away stones and a time to gather stones together. A time to embrace and a time to refrain from embracing. You go on. I'd love to hear you say the rest.
Yes, a time to seek and a time to lose, a time to keep and a time to cast away, a time to rend and a time to sow, a time to keep silence and a time to speak, a time to love and a time to hate, a time for war and a time for peace. Notice, there is a time for war. This is quite free from the prophetic eschatological point of view. The day will come when there will be no more war. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn any more war. The extremist view of good and evil is absent from here. This is the world. And by the way, I wonder whether you'd agree with me in saying that the heavy note of sadness, the ultimate pessimism, which is here and there somewhat modified, is due to the fact that these books deal with individuals. They don't deal with a people, they don't deal with society, they don't deal with a process. It is the man himself who is concerned with his own destiny. There's no feeling of his being tied to some larger issue, so that what might carry him past a period of despair and depression, namely the thought of generations to come within the framework of his labor, all that is absent.
You're speaking of the individual. Is very pertinent to a memory I suddenly have of a portrait I saw not long ago of General Zukharov, who was the the teacher in military matters of General Kutuzov, famous, you know, in Tolstoy's
War and Peace.
Peace.
Yes, yes.
Well, this old Zakharov, the great soldier of the 18th century, had a face which amazed all who were looking at it one day. Several of us looked at this portrait, and one woman suddenly said, that old man had seen everything. And
yes.
I knew what she meant.
Yes.
Because on this face was a kind of disillusion, to be sure. Nothing could ever have surprised him. No matter what had happened, what would happen, he had seen it before or had placed for it in his mind. At the same time, it was not a bitter face. It was a very compassionate face. Those two things are both here, don't you think so?
Well, yes. And perhaps here we have a clue to the reason, the ultimate reason for the inclusion of this strange and difficult and moving book in the canon, that you can entertain these thoughts. It is not sinful. It is part of man's experience to know these moments of despair, and even moments of disbelief enter into the believing man's makeup and experience. This is part of the national treasury. A people can absorb it. An individual, were he alone, couldn't absorb this pessimism, but a people can.
That's right. I mean, if your experience is that rich, then it is possible. I'm always interested in ways the author contradicts himself, but somehow amends his utterance. As, for instance, when, after having said that perhaps it would be better never to have been born than to have come into the treadmill of this life, and after he said that the grave is probably a very quiet and good place after the turmoil of this world, he says, nevertheless, a living dog is better than a dead lion.
Yes, yes, that is the...
For the living know that they shall die, but the dead know not anything, neither have they any more a reward, for the memory of them is forgotten.
Yes.
Better a living dog than a dead lion is a very wonderful statement.
By the way, there's an old quip about the question of whether it's better to never to have been born. The question was put to a man, do you think it's better never to have been born? And his reply was, maybe, but only one man in a million has that piece of luck.
No, I never heard that. Of course, there's also his suggestion that he doesn't seriously mean that one should never do nothing but sit in a kind of nerveless, relaxed, dumb, numb way. He says, whatsoever thy hand attaineth to do by thy strength, that do, for there is no work, nor device, nor knowledge, nor wisdom in the grave, whither thou goest.
Yeah, or that again, he says, Mark, he says, the fool foldeth his hands together and eateth his own flesh.
It is the fool that does that.
The fool that does that. The wise man, whatever he suffers and however it goes against his grain to endure, at least to endure without murmuring the whips and scorns of time, keeps on acting. But this is the principle of life.
And this is true for him, even though it is also true that the folly of others, or the folly of many persons in the world, seem almost to spoil the world at times. Here's this marvelous figure that, of course, you remember. One sinner destroyeth much good. Dead flies make the ointment of the perfumer fetid and putrid. So doth a little folly outweigh wisdom and honor. I'm sure he means only that it seems to. Only that when it is before your nose, you,
yes,
you smell
yes.
it.
We notice again how relentlessly they go after the fool, with as much disapproval, or I might say rancor,
yes.
As after the wicked man. Or they equate the two. And they have shadings of the word fool. It unfortunately doesn't appear in the English. The fool is a sort of a lyrical theme. There is the plain fool, the Xil, who is also called the arrogant fool. There is the Evil, who is the evil fool. There is the Naval, who is the coarse and brutal fool. All sorts of shadings. They can't let go of the subject over and over again in this literature. The sinister figure of the buffoon fool appears and reappears.
Well, let me simply remind you of something I said the other day, that someone once in my hearing defined a wise man as a man who is no kind of a fool. Sometimes you can't do any better than that. The bottom, the utter negation of wisdom is perhaps the place to begin in our attempt to understand it.
Nevertheless, Mark, He does sometimes sound a note, I won't say of envy, but of resignation with regard to the fool. He says, how dieth the wise man as the fool, and in the end it's all the same. But then he comes back again, contradicts himself. He can't come to peace with himself. One of the values that I find in the book of Ecclesiastes, one of the many values, is that it gives you no peace of mind. I have a deep resentment of the literature that makes for the peace of mind and makes for peace of soul and makes for that kind of tranquility for which, if you can't read, you can take drugs. One or the other. Either it's verbal or else it's medical. I object very strenuously to it, and the book of Ecclesiastes may be considered also, this is an additional idea, may be considered also to have been included in the canon, in the Bible, in order to prevent people from falling into that fatuous attitude of contentment with the universe.
That's right, and nothing could be wiser than that project. I'm interested in the fact that Ecclesiastes at least seems to counter the remarks of the author of Ecclesiasticus about the anonymous good man, the man who did things that are not remembered. The suggestion was that they were heroes anyway, and that they should have done them. Here, you know, he points out with that marvelous power of his, so that we cannot forget it and cannot help feeling a certain way about it, that it doesn't do anybody any good to do good. There was a city, you remember.
Oh, yes.
And there came a great
king. Yeah, read that. It's a beautiful passage.
There was a little city and few men within it, and there came a great king against it and besieged it and built great bulwarks against it. Now there was found in it a man poor and wise, and he by his wisdom delivered the city. Yet no man remembered that same poor man. Then said I, wisdom is better than strength. Nevertheless, the poor man's wisdom is despised, and his words are not heard.
Yes, it's moving. It's deeply moving. And yet he says, in spite of all.
That's right.
In spite of all. Dafka, they say in Hebrew. In spite of all, this is the right way.
I'm perfectly certain that he always means that. He's always coming back to that belief.
So that actually the book provides us with the antidote to its own poison.
Have you noticed, Maurice, how many times the word sun appears in this book? Under the sun, in the sun. The sun also rises, of course. That's
yes.
In the very fifth verse.
Well, the sun is very prominent in Palestine, in
yes.
Israel.
But here again, this man is sitting in the sun and under the sun, and he thinks of all the generations that have passed, the centuries that have passed, under that same sun.
Just heard The Words We Live By, the fifth in the 15-week Eternal Light summer series. We invite you to join us again next week for another in this series of outstanding literary dialogues of past years featuring Mark Van Doren and Maurice Samuel. Our program will be the first of 10 entitled The Supporting Cast of the Bible. The Words We Live By is produced under the auspices of the Jewish Theological Seminary of America. This pre-recorded program has been an NBC Public Affairs presentation.
This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.